to present Perennial Wisdom in A Course in Miracles with Dr. Francis Vaughn and Dr. Roger Walsh. Dr. Francis Vaughn is an author and psychologist in private practice in Mill Valley, California. She is the former president of the Association for Transpersonal Psychology and is the author of Awakening Intuition and the Inward Arc, Healing and Wholeness in Psychotherapy and Spirituality. Dr. Roger Walsh is a professor of psychiatry at the University of California at Irvine and is the author of several books, including Staying Alive, The Psychology of Human Survival, and Meditation, Classic and Contemporary Perspectives. Francis and Roger are also the co-editors of Beyond Ego, Transpersonal Dimensions in Psychology, and two books of quotations from A Course in Miracles, Accept This Gift and The Gift of Peace. Now that you know all of that about them, the most important thing to know is that they are two beautiful children of God. So please join us in welcoming Dr. Francis Vaughn and Dr. Roger Walsh.
Thank you, Beverly, and thank you all for being here this evening. You'll hear more from me a little later on because Roger has a great body of information that he would like to share with you tonight. And probably of the speakers that Beverly mentioned, I would guess that tonight's presentation will certainly be the most theoretical, shall we say. And I hope that that will be to your taste, but we do want to make room for your questions and have some interaction later on. So if you'll bear with us the first half, welcome. And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for coming.
Yes, it feels more than a privilege, a pleasure. It feels like a privilege because there is such, so many of you know, such exquisite joy in sharing this material, which has been so meaningful to us and so many of you here. And so the opportunity to discuss it and talk about it and revel in it is wonderful. So we hope you enjoy it. This evening is a wonderful demonstration example of what the course talks about, in that our desire for specialness can be transmuted into our special function, or in other words, how our neuroses can be changed into something useful. And my particular neurosis, or actually one of my particular neuroses, is a somewhat obsessional bent to loving to play with ideas and think about things, and also enjoying looking at different systems and practices. So I've spent a few years running through various types of psychotherapies and exploring a number of meditations. And this proved helpful to me when I first started with the course, because being very open-minded, when Francis showed it to me, I, of course, took a look at it, and I saw the words God, Holy Spirit in it, and I closed it and refused to have anything to do with it for 2 years. However, I was around a number of people who would drop these interesting one-liners, and I would say, wow, that's far out. Where'd you get that? And they'd say, Course in Miracles. Course in Miracles? After 2 years, my resistance was worn down, and I eventually took a look at the material and began studying quite seriously, and had grave difficulties with the language, as many of you do, I know, and spent quite some time translating it into terms with which I was more familiar, translating things into psychological language or into the language of other traditions such as Buddhism. I was doing Buddhist meditation at the time. So I spent some time translating Son of God as Buddha and other weird translations. This has actually proved useful for tonight, because what Beverly requested that we talk about was the perennial wisdom in the Course in Miracles, and how the Course relates to other traditions. And in point of fact, the Course exquisitely demonstrates or embodies the wisdom that can be found at the heart of all the world's great religions, and particularly at the heart of their deeper aspects. So today, what I'd like to do is kind of try to show you how the Course relates to these other traditions and how some of the practices in it relate to other practices. And in doing so, I'll kind of start more at an abstract level and then kind of try to provide a framework so you can see how the Course relates to other world religions and how it fits there. And then from there, we'll kind of move into the more practical questions of, you know, that we all face on our day-to-day lives. And we're at a really fascinating phase in human history where we're really, for the first time, able to make these kinds of comparisons. Because it's literally only within the last few decades that we've had available to us all the world's spiritual teachings. Never before in human history have we been able to access the texts and traditions and teachings of the world's great spiritual traditions. And by a strange coincidence also, we have for the first time available to us the newly found documents from the Nag Hammadi Library, or the Gnostic Gospels, as they've been called, which represent the deeper mystical teachings of early Christianity. And for those of you who are not familiar, the recently found Gnostic materials suggest that what we got given to us through the New Testament was actually a somewhat narrow slice of the original teachings of Jesus, which the Gnostic documents suggest had a very rich mystical dimension to them. And the Christ of the Gnostic Gospels does not speak of sin and guilt, he speaks of illusion and of awakening. Doesn't speak of himself as unique, the unique Son of God, but rather it was one person who has realized his potential, which all other people are capable of realizing also. So it's a very radically different perspective on the origins and teachings of our Western Christianity. And this fits it in much more easily with the other world religions, so we can now kind of mesh these. The other thing that's unique about our time is it's the first time in history we've had a psychology in the West which has been able to take account of things like altered states of consciousness and make sense of religion. And begin not to reduce religions merely to psychology, but to begin to appreciate that at their heart, at their esoteric core, the world's great religions can actually be seen as roadmaps to inducing transcendent states of consciousness. And this is a radically new way of looking at our spiritual paths. So we have this wonderful opportunity to begin to make sense of the world's spiritual teachings, this extraordinary global heritage that's available to us in a wholly new way, and to see them as complementary and integrating rather than as the conflictual and the necessary source of war and killing that they've been throughout human history. Well, okay, so we have all this material available to us. Can we find the underlying commonalities among these different traditions? What I'd like to do, just to give you a preamble here, is to look at the different traditions, their commonalities, what they say, their teachings, their techniques, and then see how the course fits into that. So what are the commonalities between the world's religious systems? Well, considering they make special claims to truth, they're remarkable for their diversity and differences. And if we look below the surface differences, we can begin to find common pathways there. And I'll just work with the so-called great world religions, Christianity, Judaism, Muslim tradition, Hindu, and Buddhist. We can get into enough trouble there without having to go into all the others. So I will doubtless offend anyone who has allegiance to any of these, but so be it. I know you're all into forgiveness, so I'm not terribly worried. Well, what are the similarities? You have already made a diagnosis as to my academic nature since I've started using the blackboard already. I want to suggest that all these religions do several things. First, they make a diagnosis about our condition. Then they point out our potential or prognosis. They identify a cause for why we're in the mess we're in, and they point to a pathway out. Well, what do they say about our diagnosis? Well, we can look at these things, diagnosis and potential, under these headings. What's the nature of life? What's the nature of our identity, of the mind, and our relationship, specifically our relationship to the whole, to God, the Tao, Atman, however you want to conceive it. Well, basically, they say that in our usual condition, we're looking now at diagnosis. This is the way we are. And the message that the great religions give us about our lives is basically it's the pits. Technically, it's a veil of suffering, of tears. In Buddhism, it's dukkha or unsatisfactoriness and so on. But the message is pretty clear. It ain't good. Secondly, our identity. Basically, the message here is pretty clear. It says you are suffering from a massive case of mistaken identity. You think your physical body is limited, suffering, fallen creatures. And they don't have much better to say about our minds either. We're driven by worldly desires in the grip of hatred and lust and other nasty things, and it's kind of messy. And as to our relationship to God or the whole, basically we're out of relationship. That's the key message. Either dissociated, separate, in conflict with, but whatever it is, it ain't good. Well, so that's the diagnosis. What about our potential? What do they say we can become? Well, they paint a pretty, for the most part, a pretty good picture of what we can become. Our life, they say, can become one of joy, of bliss, of love. Our identity, we can recognize ourselves as children of God, as spirit, as Atman, shifting identity towards the spiritual. Our mind, that says, can be brought into alignment with God, can be motivated by spiritual needs, by higher needs, relinquishing the attachment to things of the world. And our relationship to the whole can also be healed. We can move to relationship with God. We can be aligned with, we can acknowledge our dependence on, and rather than striving for independence. So these are just very quickly an overview of kind of the core assumptions of the great religions as we usually know them. And clearly there are some commonalities. But this raises a very, very interesting question. Is this the deepest picture that's available to us? Is it possible that if we looked at the great, not at the common beliefs, but at the great sages, the mystics, the saints, what picture would they paint for us? Would it be different? Would it show other commonalities? And in point of fact, it does. In point of fact, the pictures painted by the great spiritual figures across cultures and ages point to a picture of the world and of ourselves which shows very marked similarities, so much so that it has been called the perennial wisdom or the perennial philosophy. A view of the world and ourselves which has endured across millennia and across cultures, and which has been sourced by the greatest spiritual figures that have ever walked the earth. What is this vision of theirs? Their basic message is that this world which seems so solid and real to us is a dream. It is a creation of our own minds. In Hinduism, Brahman sits on Mount Meru and meditates, and in his each breath, in-breath and out-breath, with the in-breath creates the universe, and with the out-breath dissolves it. All the creation within the mind of God. In Tibetan Buddhism, they practice dream yoga, in which the yogis learn to be aware during their dream. Technically, in the West, we call this lucid dreaming, so they know they're dreaming. Then they teach them to be aware while they're not, during sleep when they're not dreaming, so that they fall asleep but remain aware and awake all through the night. And then they practice continuously during daytime, recalling to themselves, this is a dream, this is a dream. So 24 hours a day, there is no break in awareness and there is no loss of recognition that this is a dream. The Dalai Lama gave a talk on this at Harvard University, and someone said, well, okay, when you've done, one of the profs stood up and said, well, when you've done this, then what do you do? And the Dalai Lama said, then you take a vacation. But the other thing he says is, and this is a real mind blower, is that, well, once you can maintain awareness all the time and recognize it's a dream, then it's not too hard to stay aware as you watch yourself, as you watch the body die, and then you watch yourself reincarnate. I don't know. It's certainly a good story. So, the world is a dream in the perennial philosophy. Life, they agree, is suffering. Profound suffering for the untrained mind lost in this dream. Our identity, the perennial wisdom says, is actually pure consciousness. And yet we create a world and bodies which we take to be physical and real. Our minds have vast creative power, able to create worlds so entrapping that we assume them to be real and independent of us. And this is illusion, or samsara, or maya, or the dance of Shiva, or lila, the different terms given in different traditions to this great dream we dream together. And our relationship to the whole, the perennial wisdom says, is that we are an inseparable part of the whole. We are not separate from the mind of God. What is the cause of our problem, of our dilemma, of this illusion we find ourselves in? The perennial philosophy says very clearly, it's mind. Mind lost in illusion. And different traditions emphasize different mental processes. Some emphasize, the Indian yoga emphasizes the agitation of mind. Mind never stops moving. And yoga is defined in the sutras as, yoga is the intentional stopping of the spontaneous activity of the mind stuff. And all of us know, if we've tried to do our Course in Miracle lessons or ever tried to meditate, the mind, it just keeps moving. The Buddha said it was addiction, our craving for the things of the world which entraps us. Other parts of Buddhism have said it's our getting lost in concept, something the Course also says. Confucianism says it's selfishness. Others emphasize it's our fundamental sense that something's wrong. We view everything as a dilemma or a problem. And what's the potential that the perennial wisdom points to? It points to the possibility of awakening from the dream, of liberation, enlightenment, salvation, wu, moksha, numerous names to point to a process of waking up. And when we awake, what do we find ourselves to be? We find our true identity is pure consciousness. Or in the Hindu terms, sat, chit, ananda, awareness or consciousness, being and bliss. It's who we turn out to be, they say. Pure consciousness, pure being, pure bliss. And the different traditions point to the fact that this reality lies within us, within our own minds. Look within, thou art the Buddha, Buddhism. Atman, individual consciousness, and Brahman, consciousness of God, are one, Hinduism. He who knows himself knows God, St. Clement. He who knows himself knows his Lord, Muhammad. God dwells within you as you, Siddha Yoga. He who knows himself knows this entire universe, the Upanishads, 2,500 years ago. And the kingdom of heaven is within you. Same message, all the traditions. And this mind that entraps us so much, what's it turn out to be when we awaken? Unlimited, beyond space and time, infinitely creative, inseparable from the one mind, from Brahman, from God. And how do we move to this place? The fundamental message of the perennial wisdom is very simple. It can be summarized in two words. Wake up. Simple words. How do you do it? Well, they provide some guidelines. Basically, how do you do therapy to wake up? Well, there are many techniques and many paths, but all the paths of the perennial wisdom can be described as the threefold path involving three things: living ethically, training attention and understanding or wisdom. Ethics. Often this is interpreted in traditional religion as kind of moralistic, don't do that or God will get you, guilt-based. But the perennial wisdom says no. That's not what ethics is about. It's not that God will get you if you're bad. It's that unethical behavior, harming others, comes out of emotions and drives such as greed and anger and jealousy and fear and reinforces them. So that to act in a way which hurts others reinforces the emotions which keep us entrapped. It hardens the illusion. So ethics is seen not as guilt-based, but as simply a strategic means of reducing such things as fear and anger and hatred and jealousy. So it is ethics in this tradition is seen as a tool for awakening. So that's the first part of the threefold path. Second is training attention. All of us who have meditated, or all of us who have tried to do the lessons in the course, know you sit there, and within 5 seconds, the mind's off wandering in some fantasy, or having this conversation, or blah, blah, blah. And you bring it back. Oh, yes, I was doing a lesson. 5 seconds later, bang, yeah, back, bang. Yeah. And it's for that reason that it's said that the spiritual path consists of simply waking up one more time than you fall asleep. And the final part of this threefold path is wisdom or understanding. And there are various levels to that. The first level is simply recognizing, hey, something's wrong. There must be a better way. And if you recall, those of you who know the start of how the Course in Miracles came to be, it came out of Helen Schuckman and Bill Thetford fighting like cats and dogs and saying to each other, there has to be a better way. And lo and behold, a better way was given to them. And as one then begins on a path, then one starts to act ethically. And when one acts ethically, then fear and anger and aggression are reduced. And so one can direct the mind more consciously, which allows one to penetrate deeper in one's understanding and build wisdom and understanding, which leads to greater attention, which leads to greater ethicality, and feeds on itself in a positive spiral. So those are the common elements of all the effective paths. Then there are different types of paths. The different yogas, the three classical yogas, are bhakti, jnana, and karma. Bhakti, the three types of paths. Bhakti is the path of love, of devotion. That's one path. Another path is jnana yoga, the path of understanding or wisdom or cultivating an understanding of our dilemma and the way the mind works and entraps us and paring away our false beliefs. And karma yoga is the yoga of work and service in the world, in which one goes into the world in order to work to relieve suffering and uses that work as the means of awakening self and others at the same time, so that you aim to treat both the suffering and its psychological spiritual cause, thereby adopting an all-encompassing path which aims to treat symptom and cause, psyche and world, self and other. And you go into yourself to go more effectively out into the world, and you go out into the world to go more deeply into yourself, and you keep that cycle going as long as you think inside and outside are different. And it's interesting that in the study of world history, the great historian Arnold Toynbee found the one characteristic of the truly great contributors to human history and development was this cycle of withdrawal and return, withdrawing for periods of time and going back into the world to serve. And the greatest ideal of this is the world server, the person who commits their lives to the service of others and to awakening. And there are different emphases. There's grace versus effort and faith versus good works and those things. You know. But those are the three major types of paths. And there are different levels of development that are possible. One of the great breakthroughs in recent years has been that now that these different teachings are available to us, people have been able to identify different stages and levels of spiritual development. And it's been found that to some extent it's possible to say that one matures through various psychological levels and then goes on into various spiritual levels. And these spiritual levels can be looked at in three major classes, which can be thought of as follows. That is, there are the subtle levels of spiritual development, the causal levels of spiritual development, the absolute levels. What do these mean? Very simply, the subtle level is the level of which one's awareness becomes more refined, more sensitive, and one becomes aware of the inner universe that exists, the images, the vast realms of the inner mind. And then in the causal level, one goes beyond images, beyond even the appearance or images of or visions of saints or of God, to the kind of ground of consciousness out of which all the world arises. And then beyond that is the absolute level in which consciousness is recognized as the foundation from which the world arises, and yet this person is able to, has moved so far that they're no longer attached to the world, but no longer are they attached to the spiritual either, so that they can move between world and spiritual realms backwards and forwards freely. And it's interesting that if we look at the history of religions, actually one can trace over the millennia that religions have gradually accessed higher levels of development. You know, the early shamans, the first explorers, religious explorers, accessed these subtle realms, as did the yogis. The Buddha and Christ clearly accessed the causal realm. The Father and I are one. The recognition there is no separation between this mind and the one mind. So, this is a very, very brief summary of the perennial wisdom. How's the course fit with this? Well, clearly the course is in line with the Gnostic teachings that were lost to us for almost 2,000 years. I think clearly it stands in that great mystical tradition of Christ. The course also it squares very nicely with the perennial wisdom. The course absolutely makes no pretense about it. This is a dream. Dreams show you that you have the power to make a world as you would have it be, and that because you want it, you see it. And while you see it, you do not doubt that it is real. Yet here is a world clearly within your mind that seems to be outside it. You do not respond to it as though you made it, nor do you realize that the emotions the dream produces come from you. You seem to waken and the dream is gone, yet what you fail to recognize is that what caused the dream has not gone with it, and what you seem to waken to is but another form of this same world you see in dreams. All your time is spent in dreaming. Couldn't get a clearer statement of it anywhere. It's also pretty clear that life is tough. You know, life, living as an ego, thinking you're a body which is prey to sickness and suffering and death, is not much fun. It also says our bodies are creations of mind, as the perennial wisdom does, and that our mind is distorted by illusions. Very clear. Well, let's see. Mind reaches to itself. Within itself, it has no limits, and there is nothing outside it. It encompasses you entirely, you within it, and it within you. And it acknowledges that we are one with God. Let me remember I am one with God, one with all my brothers and myself. Right in line with the perennial teaching. And what's our potential? Clearly, salvation, liberation, awakening is available. What's our identity? One with God, child of God. And what's our mind? Infinitely creative. vast, unlimited in its creative power. And how does it awaken us? What's its particular path? The exquisite thing about the Course is that it integrates so many diverse teachings and so many diverse paths. It employs and integrates all the three of the yogas we talked about. It integrates Jnana Yoga, the knowledge. I mean, this is an exquisite piece of psychological text. I mean, you want to learn about the mind, this is better than anything I've seen in any psychological textbook. It also emphasizes relationship. In fact, the Course is unique among the world's spiritual traditions in its emphasis on relationship as the vehicle for awakening. No other tradition that I have ever found anywhere so focuses on relationship as key to awakening. And it emphasizes service, karma yoga. Very clearly says that no one's going to make it fully until everyone makes it. And that in awakening others, we awaken ourselves. To awaken others is to awaken ourselves. This is the path of yoga, karma yoga. And as to its depths, well, clearly the Course accesses all levels of spiritual development. I can't really speak to the levels it assesses, because it clearly assesses a heck of a lot more than I can. But even though I can't assess it, the Course may be beyond our ability to assess fully, but certainly not beyond our ability to appreciate and to enjoy and to feel grateful for. We've truly been given a gift of God. Gift of God, by definition, is something which no one loses and everyone gains. And this is clearly what we've been given. Extraordinary teaching, just extraordinary in its profundity, in its comprehensiveness, in its integration. I've found no other text anywhere that is so complete and fully integrated. Just remarkable. And sharing it is such a gift. So exquisite to be able to share this material. I feel so grateful for the opportunity. Whenever anyone starts working with it, I'm just so grateful for that. And I'm so grateful to have this opportunity of being with you, because as the Course says, to share our joy is to increase it. So I thank you very much for the opportunity of increasing our joy. Thank you.
Quite an act to follow. I think that Roger and I have from time to time done programs together over the years, and we've never really worked it out where we did something together. It's usually turn-taking, but nevertheless it's always a learning experience for both of us. So I must say that working with this material together has really made a difference in our lives, in our relationship, and so we each have our own styles of using it, and yet I think that we do share the appreciation of the material and what it has. Better not to touch those, I guess. I'm stuck behind the podium, but anyway, what a difference it's made in our lives. I'd like to focus a little differently this evening and talk more about experience, because one of the things that the Course says is that a universal theology is impossible, but a universal experience is not only possible but necessary. And this is the universal element that is apparent in any spiritual path, that you need to go beyond concepts and thinking about it to experience. Now, different traditions will give instructions to do this in different ways, but ultimately you come back to needing to go inward, to find it in yourself. That in the Zen tradition, for example, there are stages that are on the path The first being the stage of exploring, finding a path, choosing a teacher, and then the second being one of studying the wisdom teachings. The third, coming to the realization that you find it not through books or somebody else's teaching, but ultimately in your own experience. So in some traditions, we talk about this as getting in touch with your own inner wisdom or opening the heart. And in the Course, it has to do with a shift in perception or the awakening to vision. I wanted to talk a little bit about the whole element of vision and perception here, because again, this is a universal element in all the traditions, and it's treated slightly differently in each one. The one that I find so similar to the Course comes from the Hindu tradition, which suggests that Maya, illusion, is what we live in. It's hard to talk about because it's what we exist in all the time. However, Maya is said to have three powers, and those powers are the power of obscuring, the obscuring power, that would be distortions of perception. There is then the power of projection. Well, the Course says a lot about projection, that what we don't want to see in ourselves, we see out there instead, so that all of our fear, all of our guilt, all of our anger gets projected out there. The third power of Maya is the revealing power. This is the power that becomes available when we start paying attention to our experience, and that clearly we begin to see through the illusion, the lifting of the veil. You know, that's one of my favorite sections in the Course, when it talks about the lifting of the veil. So when you see through the illusion and into the reality, into the mystery that is behind all of, that lies behind appearances, this is when you awaken to love. The experience of love is one of seeing through the illusion, so that the underlying reality that we become aware of is that our true nature is love. And that's true in any tradition. They may not put those words on it the way the Course does. The Course says, teach only love because that is what you are. But essentially this is there. It's certainly there in the Sufi tradition, where they say we have to learn to see with the eye of the heart. And there's the eye of the mind, which understands rational things. There's the eye of the body, our visual senses that orient us to the world and interact with the environment. But the eye of the heart is awakened through compassion, through love, through an experience of love. Now, the experience of love also is a universal that appears in all traditions. And basically, we can identify five types of love that appear in every spiritual tradition. The first type is the love of servant for master. Now, we see this in the traditions of gurus, where the disciple really has a heart connection to the guru. And what we sometimes don't understand when we criticize from the outside and we see that, oh, how can a disciple think that everything the guru does is a teaching, when the guru is perhaps out there doing things he shouldn't be doing and he has all these human failings? What we fail to recognize that in a way, this is a training of perception. Now, the Course suggests that everyone is our teacher. So the Course suggests that we need to train ourselves to see everything as a teaching. So instead of saying, all right, you take one person who is a master, has some mastery in this in domain, and then you attempt to see him, it's usually a him, anyway, that it's as a manifestation of divine love. Well, the Course suggests that we need to learn to see each other, see Christ in each other, to see each one of us as a manifestation of that divine love. Well, there's another, the second type of love that is universal, is the love that's experienced in friendship. And I think this is particularly strong in the Course, because that's the love between in course language, brothers, in between all of us as peers. That is, it's a non-hierarchical kind of love. When you're with a friend that you really love, you can really be yourself. There are no pretenses, there's nothing you have to hide, and you're thinking about your friend all the time. This may be characterized as similar to the relationship between Jesus and the disciples. There's a quality of friendship there. And this too can be an awakening of the heart or an experience of love. There's a sense of brotherhood, sistership. In all the different traditions, this exists in spiritual communities. Then, let's see, the third type of love that we find universally in all traditions is the love of parent for child. And you don't have to be a parent to experience the love of a baby. And it's the love that is evoked at Christmas in the nativity scene. It's where, as the Course says, Christ comes demanding nothing. No sacrifice is asked of him, by him, of anyone. Here's this innocent child that awakens love in the heart. And if you see the Christmas imagery as the awakening of that child, the birth of the Christ light in you, or the birth of that awareness in the heart, it becomes a universal experience. This is the universal experience that we're talking about when we talk about awakening. It's the discovery that we have a capacity for love, that love is in us. There's no one, as the Course says, who has not had an experience of love, who doesn't know what love is. Even if you feel that you know what love is only because you feel a lack of it, nevertheless, there's no one in the world who doesn't have some sense of what that experience of love is. And that is true of all people in all cultures. I have had the opportunity to do a fair amount of traveling and lecturing overseas, and I don't think I've ever met anyone who didn't want to be able to give and receive love. And so this kind of love that's awakened for a child also can be a very healing experience. There's this nice story that's told about the Indian Saint Ramakrishna, when a woman came to him and said, I don't love God. I'm sorry, but I don't know what love is. I don't feel that I love God at all. And he said to her, well, is there nothing in the world that you love? And she said, well, yes, I love my little nephew. And he said, there he is. In your service to your nephew, you are in service to the divine. It is in where you are in service to the person that you love, wherever that love is awakened, this is where we perceive the divine. So then the fourth kind of love is love between spouses. And this, traditionally, of course, marriage was socially arranged. It wasn't something that you chose freely. It was something that you essentially just were expected to do. And the kind of loyalty, the kind of commitment, the kind of partnership that could develop between spouses was a special bond and a special love. And that could be very enduring. So that's another opportunity to experience that universal experience, to really be in it. And the fifth, of course, is romantic love. Now, I think that the experience of falling in love is often an opening, that it can be an inspiration. It can be what perhaps the jolt that wakes us up sometimes. And it doesn't matter whether the relationship works out or not. It's not about what happens in the relationship. I mean, it works out in terms of having it meet the pictures of how relationships are supposed to be. Now, it's, I think, useful to remember that Dante, who was the great poet of romantic love, never had any social relationship with Beatrice at all. She led him to paradise. But that was that she inspired the heart. She opened the heart and gave him an experience of love, which took him through the gates of paradise. Reason, symbolized by Virgil, could take him only so far, but reason can take us up to a point. But beyond that, unless the heart is opened, unless we participate in the experience of love, we are stuck in the wasteland of alienation, of separation, and of despair. So I think it's really helpful to remember that the experience of love and is one of the is the universal experience that underlies all spiritual paths in some form. And we are talking about different doorways, different ways of accessing that. Yet in all of the different traditions, all of these five doorways are available. Now, in our culture, we have done a lot of work in recent years to try and bring those last two